On the Record on News Talk.
Brought to you by PwC, a community of solvers coming together in unexpected ways. It all adds up to the new equation.
Plenty to come up in the show today and a lot of different things to discuss in the papers. But before we do that, I'll just give you a quick guide of what's making the front pages this morning. We'll start with the Irish Mail on Sunday, which leads with an interview with the widow of one of the crew members lost on Rescue 116, who says, "I fear they died in vain." The widow of one of the search and rescue heroes killed in the ill-fated OR-116 helicopter crash says she fears the tragedy could happen again and that her husband and his three colleagues may have died in vain. Winchman Kieran Smith's heartbroken widow Martina broke her silence this weekend about the investigation into one of the country's worst air accidents in an exclusive interview with the Mail on Sunday. The mother of three says that there are many inconsistencies in the 400-page report completed by the Air Accident Investigation Unit, that she no longer has full confidence in the process tasked with finding out what happened in the early hours of March 14th, 2017. She told the Mail on Sunday, "I'm crushed and I'm heartbroken again. This report leaves me very fearful that this could happen again and more families will be left without mothers and fathers." The front page of the Business Post tells us that for all the discussion of targets about the national broadband plan and the Taoiseach even maybe dialing back some expectations a couple of weeks ago, we're now told that fewer than 3,000 homes and businesses have been connected to high-speed internet under the multi-billion euro national broadband plan. That's in the first 21 months of its rollout. The 5.7 billion euro rural broadband scheme is now lagging far behind its initial rollout target of making the network available to 115,000 premises by the second year of the contract. That's at the end of January 2022. It's now aiming to reach just 60,000 premises by that date instead. As of mid-October, National Broadband Ireland had passed, that's the industry jargon, had passed just 17,000 of those 60,000 premises. The Business Post has learned that of those homes and businesses with access to the network, just 2,700 have been signed up and been connected by October 27th, 2,700. Clearly a lot of a way to go there. Also on the front page of the Business Post, we're told that the revenue commissioners are reducing the tax penalties for holders of secret offshore accounts who come forward voluntarily. It garnered more than 130 million euro from its investigation into Ansbacher offshore accounts in the early 2000s, but the haul from offshore accounts dwindled to just 1 million euro last year, so revenue are now going to lower the penalties for people who come forward voluntarily. And also on the front page of the Business Post, the government's target of achieving an 80% cut in energy emissions is in doubt. That's just, what, 3 or 4 days after that plan was published? The target of achieving an 80% cut in energy emissions is in doubt because some of the world's largest renewable energy companies continue to raise concerns about the dysfunctional nature of Ireland's planning process for offshore wind. More about that maybe in the next hour if we get to come to it. The front page of the Sunday Times this morning leads with a story that we might put to Stephen Donnelly when he's with us later in the programme. A rift has emerged between Ireland's political leaders and some of its most senior medical advisers over whether to run a nationwide vaccine booster campaign to combat the latest wave of COVID infections. Tony Houlihan and Cillian de Gascoigne, and along with Philip Nolan, have seen those strong reservations about the benefits of a population-wide booster programme. Nolan says that where boosters are necessary to offer protection against severe illness, they do that quickly. But the bigger question is whether they're going to re-medicate an entire population as a substitute for some basic health measures like washing your hands or wearing a mask in public transport. Meanwhile, though, Leo Varadkar on the Taoiseach calling publicly on Friday for boosters for the under-60s, and the Taoiseach Micheál Martin saying that the European perspective is that over time vaccines will be used in respect of COVID regularly. Also on the front page of the Sunday Times, deep retrofitting of older houses could take 15 to 20 years before the property owners can recoup the cost of their investment, which is maybe a bit of a barrier as to why people would cover the costs up front. And we're also told that councillors are lobbying for babysitting costs to be refunded when they attend local authority meetings. The Association of Irish Local Government, which is a group representing local councillors, has written to the government seeking a number of changes to the expenses system, including that childcare costs and expenses associated with hiring carers for dependents should be reimbursed. That's an interesting one. We might get to that at some point in the next hour as well. Front page of the Sunday Independent, also again on the booster topic, the government is coming under increasing pressure this weekend to over the rollout of COVID-19 booster programmes. One health expert warns that delays in giving a third jab to the over 60s could cost lives. Immunologist Luke O'Neill, more than familiar to listeners of this parish, says NIAC, the state's immunisation advisory body, should act out of character and make a rapid decision to allow all people over 60 to be vaccinated 5 months after the second shot or sooner. This is now urgent, giving rising case numbers. Delaying it by a month could cost lives. And he has written extensively inside the paper about the examples of Israel, which has done that and seen a dramatic fall in the number of infections there. But also something which might be of interest to a lot of parents listening this morning who might be wondering about the rising case numbers, particularly when their kids are going to be spending more time indoors in schools again. Recommendations on testing and contact tracing in schools are among measures being considered by the Health Minister, Stephen Donnelly, according to the CMO, Tony Houlihan. I'm not going to explain the full guts of this story because we have in studio with us Kevin Doyle, who's the Group Head of News at Independent Newspapers. Kevin, you might give us an overview as to what exactly Tony Houlihan is telling the Minister for Education.
Yeah, it will probably come. A lot of people probably scratch their head there, Gavin, when they hear you saying they're considering test and tracing for schools, didn't we have that and we stopped that, and that is the case. So you're right to be a little bit confused if you are. What has happened here now is that over the midterm break, Norma Foley, the Education Minister, wrote to Tony Holland, the Chief Medical Officer, basically asking for some advice on how to keep schools operating going forward, how to keep schools open and what the next steps, I suppose, should be, given where we are with the rising rate of COVID-19 again. And now he's replied with some stuff that we would expect from Tony Holohan. He repeats the mantra that schools are not high risk places, that while there are high numbers of children, that most of those cases are actually as a result of household transmission, that if we don't keep community transmission down, then children are going to get it and schools will be in trouble. But getting to the crux of it, he then reveals to Norma Foley that her Fianna Fáil and Cabinet colleague, Stephen Donnelly, is considering a report from the European Centre for Disease Control, who have been looking, I suppose, internationally at what is happening in schools in a range of different countries. And they're coming up with what might be seen as best practice. And part of that, it seems to be this kind of three-pronged approach. So in the first instance, you would have testing only of close contacts of a confirmed case. So if you have a child who has COVID-19, that maybe only the children in their very close vicinity within the classroom
in
setting,
their pod, basically.
Yeah, would be tested. If two or more cases were found as a result of that, then the entire class would be tested. And if additional cases were found as a result of that, then you would have the classroom quarantined and that will be sent home. So that's one element of it. And then the other side of this is what they're calling test to stay. And that is basically the introduction of antigen tests, which obviously we have been talking about for months, if not years at this stage.
And test to stay, it sounds like it's pretty much what it says on the tin, the idea that you are basically excluded unless you start taking rapid antigen tests, and as long as they come up clear, then you can go back
in. Yeah, a little bit more like what's happening in the UK, where antigen tests seem to be widely used among school kids to bring in that kind of a system.
Tanya Ward is also with us. She's the Chief Executive of the Children's Rights Alliance. Tanya, good morning and thanks for coming in. It is a tricky balance to be struck between the idea of making sure the children don't often miss school unnecessarily, which was clearly a major problem in September, where a lot of children were deemed to be close contacts, missing a lot of school, a formative time, particularly after so many sustained outages. Nobody wants to be absent for that long. And simultaneously making sure that children are not actively put into harm's way or an environment in which, despite all of the assurances, where there is clearly a lot of evidence of people contracting COVID. Where do you think the balance is to be struck?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I think they made the right decision earlier in the year when NEFID recommended suspending the test and tracing system that we had in place earlier in the year, because it actually was, if you look at the overall result of what was happening, they were, children obviously were sent home to be tested. They were saying that primary school children, about 4%, were being tested and will come up positive. And so you had lots of invasive testing on a mass population basis, children missing huge amounts of school. I know even my own family, my daughter had 8 tests. She lost nearly up to 30 days schooling between
8 tests
between March and June. So she lost another extra nearly 30 days of school and she was negative.
That's in a 4-month period. So she basically missed a quarter of school time for that period.
Yeah. So every outbreak that happened, the school was closed. There's an outbreak in my son's class. The school is closed. She's been tested again. And the school is doing everything it can to try and minimise the effects of it. But the truth is, it's an enormous interruption in children's lives. And if you're looking at, let's say, a disadvantaged child or a child that's struggling already, any of these breaks in schooling, it always results in a lot of children just not coming back again. So they weren't getting the balance right. Now, what's interesting with this approach coming from the European guidance is this test to stay strategy. I mean, it's kind of saying, look, if you're symptom free, you do an antigen test, there's no reason why you can't continue to attend in schools. And I think it's a much more reasonable approach, to be honest, this stepwise approach. So they should try and minimise the amount of spreading that's happening within school, if it does happen at all. I mean, and the truth is, a lot of the spreading that's happening, you do have these isolated instances where there is, for some reason, one particular case does spread in the classroom. I saw that in another child in relation to my family. And I think this approach is going to deal with that.
As someone who that has just outlined some of the disruptions you've had, given that one of your kids basically missed a quarter of school between March and June, there'll be a lot of people listening this morning who think that the policy around schools and the decision not to step up the contact tracing as it was done is basically because schools are not only an educational facility, but also a valuable support of childcare, and that the economy couldn't work, and that parents like you or like me would not be able to go to our day jobs unless there was somewhere to leave the children. And that's the reason why some of the possible risks of transmission are being ignored.
I mean, I heard people say that, but if you look at the data and the evidence that they were looking at the very basis, you know, COVID behaves differently with children, particularly younger children. So the data is going to look different. There's a lot of mitigation measures in place in schools, so it doesn't spread in the same way. And the data was showing at that point in time, only 4% of children were testing positive. Even though there's a whole population approach, I think it was a very reasonable approach for an effort to recommend. No doubt it obviously had benefits for parents as well, you know, on a secondary basis. But my child didn't benefit from losing 30 days of school between March and June, especially when she didn't have COVID all the way through that.
And I suppose there's the argument too that you don't want a kid to contract COVID, because even if COVID is a mild disease for them, the risks of long COVID could be much more detrimental down the line. But at the same time, you also can't exclude them from school 8 times in 4 months, because the risk is always going to be there, and it's a very short-term solution that doesn't really address the long-term crisis that there is as well. Kevin, there's a very interesting piece written by Luke O'Neill, again in page 17 of today's Sunday Independent. He's been writing weekly columns, but there's a lot of sort of factual basis behind what he's writing today about the idea that the state should just get off its high horse and either circumvent NIAC or basically encourage NIAC to get moving and to prescribe boosters for everyone at large over 60.
Yeah, I think Luke hasn't been shy about giving NIAC a kicking over the last year and a bit. And he's making the point today, which has worked its way onto the front page of the Indo as well, which is that we're having all these debates when we could actually be getting on and doing this. And we see a bit of this in the Sunday Times as well, where we're told that there's a row between NEFID and government. Not so much a row as a difference of opinion between NEFID and government ministers over what to do on the booster campaign. And Luke O'Neill is basically making the argument that it has worked in Israel, that the rapid rise in COVID now means that we have to do something to stop this. And if we don't want to close the country down again, well, then booster shots all round is where we're going. And you kind of have to think that he probably has a point, because the numbers are going up and up. Ministers seem to accept that they're going to continue going up. NEFID seem to accept that they're going to continue to go up. And we do
not indefinitely. Apparently the models are that they'll peak soon enough and then begin to tail off. But we've heard that before too.
We've seen the models before, and the models tend to be a bit like economic predictions during the Celtic Tiger.
Soft landing.
Yes, that kind of stuff. So it is, look, it's tricky, and there are all sides of debate, but I think ultimately they should just make a decision, because there is obviously the whole debate around whether we, as three of us sitting here as healthy people under 60, should be getting vaccines, boosters, when there is a huge portion of the global population that don't have them. And I know we'll talk about climate in a while, but there is a little bit of, well, you know, if it impacts me and I can solve my problems, let me solve them first and I'll get on to your problems afterwards.
Which is a fair idea, and we could argue about vaccine equity until the cows come home. And this is a point that I'll make to Stephen Donnelly later on. But, you know, you recall at times during the year where we thought vaccine progress was going really slowly, and that we seemed to be behind some of our English-speaking neighbours elsewhere in the world. And then as spring turned to summer and began to get into autumn, we were doing hundreds of thousands, often 300,000 a week. You would think that if we've proven now that we have the capacity to do 300,000 doses a week, if you decided that the political willpower was there to give a booster to everyone over 60, a lot of whom as well, by the way, didn't get mRNA first time around. They might have received AstraZeneca, which has a weaker defence against Delta to begin with, that you could basically get the lion's share of them done in about a fortnight, if you really wanted to just activate all the machinery to the level that they were there, which would be a huge boost going into a December and January.
And this, I don't fully understand what is happening. So it's good that you'll ask Stephen Donnelly this later, Gavin, because it does strike me that we could move through this very fast. Obviously, NIAC were very slow to admit, well, they would say they They studied the science and took their time, obviously. But to the rest of us, they seemed very slow to make a decision on health workers. The rollout to the over 80s is still not complete, even though it's been going on for weeks. We're getting to the over 60s. And, you know, we haven't even talked. There's people, I know people myself in the immunocompromised position who've gone over 6 months on AstraZeneca and haven't heard a single word. And when they ask their medical professionals, is kind of a shrug of the shoulders of, well, you know, it'll get to you sometime. Well,
is it even clear whether you're supposed to go back to your consultant, or is your GP supposed to contact you? Do they even know what the chain of command is supposed
to
be?
Well, as I understand it, if for example, you're a cancer patient dealing with a hospital, you're supposed to deal with the hospital, but there seems to be a lot of uncertainty around it. It's not very clear, because obviously in the first round you had to apply for it and the messaging was all very clear and you had to sign up and there was kind of an onus on you. But it does seem to be incredibly slow, given that we have the vaccines. We don't have the same scale of vaccine centres, but you would imagine you could turn that tap back on very quickly.
Yeah.
And that you could certainly have done the over 60s in the space of a couple of weeks, as you say, Gavin, if you really wanted.
There is the other argument, though, Tanya, which is that, and I'm sure this is what the minister will say later on, that it's a very brave politician who goes against whatever their scientific advice is, and that NIAC... Stephen Donnelly said before that part of the reason why he believes Irish vaccine take-up has been so high is because ministers don't meddle. Yeah. They wait for NIAC to do whatever it wants. Sometimes NIAC gets in the government's way and says, stop using AstraZeneca or stop using Johnson & Johnson, and it can be inconvenient, but that there is an outside scrutineer and that government shouldn't go against the advice of its advisors, even if that does mean acting slower than we'd like.
That's right. And I suppose one of the challenges, I think, when you do take the science approach, is it takes time sometimes for them to go through the figures. And sometimes you need to have a leap of faith, even though the full science results haven't come through yet. I mean, I think on this particular issue, there is a real argument around, if the 6 months have passed and you've medically vulnerable people out there, we shouldn't be in a situation where they haven't gotten the booster. Like, I think that's very clear. And if they were to start anywhere, that's where they need to go. They also need to think about, I think, for medically vulnerable people under the age of 60 as well. I mean, there's a real issue there. I mean, a lot of people are living very different lives, to be honest, to the rest of us. They are self-isolating. They're living at home and they're afraid again. People are afraid again. I've noticed that in the last 2 months. People are starting to say, I'm not going to meet you because of X, Y and Z. So I do think they're going to have to step up. NIAC is going to have to step up its approach. Holohan's going to have to step up his approach. We need to see some sort of political action in response to that.
I think, Gavin, there's an interesting point, though, in what you asked there around the advice from NPHET and NIAC, because what are they advising on? You know, are they looking at the global picture and equity and all that, or are they advising on pure medicine and then a government makes a policy decision? Because if you read the Sunday Times story today, where it talks about the NPHET officials worrying that if we start giving boosters to everybody, that you're basically re-medicating an entire population, when you should really be focusing on forcing, inverted commas, encouraging that population to go back to hand washing, to go back to, you know, not hugging and shaking hands and keeping your distance and all the rest of it. And the question is, that to me sounds like the government decision to make, is to either remedicate. NPHET should be telling us, and NIAC, is it safe to remedicate? Can you give the boosters? And then you would imagine that the policy decision is the government says, no, we're looking for all sorts of reasons.
Do you want people to take continual medication if that's the price of being able to ride on a train without a face mask?
It's meant to be the public health advice, which is Tony Holohan and his team. Yeah. That's what it's meant to be, because they're taking account of everything. They're taking account of what NPHET is saying, but they're also taking account on the national public interest as well and trying to mediate that all together. I mean, I can see what the issue is at Holohan has, is if we just put out boosters and then people stop social distancing, you know, that's a real problem, particularly for those vulnerable people in the population as well, because they're meant to be protecting them. I think what they probably have to do is come out with a clearer message, really, about how we're meant to behave in this phase, because I have felt this time round it's not clear, you know.
It's all on you, Tanya.
Yeah.
It's all on you.
Well, look, as an employer, like in the Children's Rights Alliance, we were waiting for the advice to come from government. That was kind of unclear what we're meant to do. So we had to bring in a consultant to tell us, etc. There's something there, I think, about the public messaging at this stage about living with COVID.
Well, I certainly think you're right. In workplaces, it is all over the shop. It's not at all clear what employers are supposed
because we've already had the phased return to work, which means a lot of people are now back at work, even though there's
Except
already advice that you're not supposed to come back to work until spring.
You're only supposed to be there for specific reasons.
One texter from Cork says, to be fair to the HSE, I got my booster jab a week ago. I was called because I was on the immunocompromised list. I had my original jabs back in April. Glad to hear that person has gotten theirs. Paul says, I thought schools were safe. Children don't spread to each other in the classroom. Children don't get sick, etc. Or maybe all of that wasn't in fact the case. Who could have seen this happening? As a patient, I find it all, as a parent, I find it all very confusing. Keep your text coming, 53106. Should say, just before we go to a quick break, a very interesting piece today in the Business Post by the data journalist Rachel Lavin. She and Seamus Coffey, an economist in UCC, have done a deep dive into figures on RIP.ie, which, although informal as it sounds, is basically our best real-time monitor of how many deaths are actually occurring in Ireland. And the number of excess deaths that there are now over previous years does seem to be in excess of anything you can attribute to COVID-19, which now makes you wonder whether people are now beginning to succumb to health conditions that were not addressed or intercepted through all the various lockdowns. Some interesting thoughts there. And as I said, we'll discuss all of that with Stephen Donnelly a little bit later in the show. Stay with us, though. We're going to be talking more with Kevin and Tanya about COP26 and the changes we're all going to have to make to our lifestyles for better or worse when we're back after this. 11:27 and on the record, Gavin Riley with you this Sunday morning, going through today's Sunday papers with Tanya Ward of the Children's Rights Alliance and Kevin Doyle, who's the group head of news at Independent Newspapers. Understandably, given the week that was in it with the ongoing talks in Glasgow at COP26 and the publication this week of the government's climate action plan, there is an awful lot written in today's papers about what it's going to ask of us all. Caroline Doherty has written a good spread in today's Sunday Independent. Niamh Horan is talking about the impact on farmers. There's a column in today's Business Post by Colin Murphy, who's talking about how there's a bit too much doom and gloom in the media coverage. Jared Howland is talking about the rural response to the climate action plan being the coalition's next big hurdle. Tanya, I know this is a very open-ended question, but there's so much written. Anything that jumped out for you in the papers this morning?
Yeah, I mean, the same language being used, you know, when it described COP26. This is the end game. This is the game changer. This is the one that has to turn the tide. I mean, what really strikes me about this particular one is that I do feel there is a growing sense that this is it. I mean, you know, you're getting that coming from political leaders now, and an acceptance that something has to change. I think what's significant as well coming through is that, you know, some of the countries that are most affected by this aren't always being heard, you know, at these big events. It's the big industrial countries that have the power, that have the money, but the countries that mightn't exist, or most of their population won't exist, or will have to leave, you're not really hearing much from them. What is interesting about this particular coverage is that there are solutions, real solutions coming through. I think that's important, because I think for the public, it's very hard to deal with this. It's like dealing with child protection abuse situations. Very hard for the public to read it because of what it means for their children and for their grandchildren. Yeah. So what you hear in this kind of coverage is there's actually some good solutions emerging. So, you know, 100 nations committed to end deforestation by 2030. Mm. That's really significant because, you know, forests act as a sink for CO2. And that's a game changer. A lot of talk as well about methane, you know, methane, or the farmers won't be happy about it. But, you know, often the focus isn't on methane because it dissipates in the atmosphere. But they're saying if you introduce measures to control methane, it'll have a much bigger effect. Mm. But the other thing coming through, and I think this is where the public has to engage with, we're on progress for a 3% degree increase by the end of the century.
Yeah.
That is, you know, low-lying parts of the world, people having to leave, cities disappearing, parts of the country disappearing, parts of the world being uninhabitable, they're being too hot, you know, massive rain, flooding, areas where people have to just relocate to other parts of the world. You're talking more famine. It's all ahead of us. And if they do introduce measures, they're talking about trying to get to 1.5 degrees by the end of the century, that we can minimise a lot of that. So I think there's a need for us as you know, as a population, to get real with what the figures are telling us and the science is telling us, and at the same time kind of focus on the solutions so we all get to play our role.
Just before I ask Kevin what in today's coverage jumps out for him, just when you mentioned the forum that the lesser countries get to be heard, I was there in Glasgow for Monday and Tuesday of this week for the world leaders leg of the summit, and one thing which was really striking was that there was a forum, yes, for some of the world leaders from Caribbean and Pacific Island nations to talk about how this wasn't an abstract thing. This is literally their lives. Yeah. Their countries are facing wipeout. The Prime Minister of Tuvalu spoke on the second day. Tuvalu is the first country in the world that has ever recorded climate refugees, because as long as 10 years ago, that country was already seeing parts of its land that were simply uninhabitable and people having to leave and go and seek refuge in other countries because their homes had literally disappeared. There was the Prime Minister of Palau who spoke on Tuesday as well. His is an archipelago nation in the Pacific, and he said, if you keep us alive so that we have more extreme weather, more scorching sun, more violent sea storms, you might as well drop bombs on our islands because we're not going to be able to survive it. Yeah. Don't give us a long-winded, dwindling existence. Get rid of us. The only problem being, a lot of those leaders were scheduled to talk on the second day, and if they actually wanted an audience of world leaders to speak to, by day two, when Micheál Martin was also there, there were precious few left in the room because some of them had either packed up and flown on their jets and gone home, or they were off in other fringe meetings, and maybe the economic impact or the human impact of all of that was completely missed. So it was a shame that those who maybe had the greatest vulnerability to climate change were the ones who were talking to, unfortunately, fairly empty halls. Kevin, like I said, there's so much written in today's papers. You could start anywhere. Anything that jumps out for you today?
Well, just a counterpoint, Tanya's. I sense that this time we mean it. This time it's for real. Mm. I think Colin Murphy's piece in the Sindo is kind of interesting because he goes through how, you know, Prince Charles is there saying this is literally the last chance saloon. Mm. And you have Le Monde in France talking about one last chance before disaster. But then he kind of rewinds the clock a little bit and goes, well, if COP26 is the last chance, what was Paris in 2015? Because that was dubbed the last chance by the BBC, or Copenhagen in 2009, which was the last chance. And then he makes quite a funny reference, which I actually didn't know about. This The Guardian apparently used to run a monthly series called 100 Months to Save the World. And they got to 100 months in January 2017, and the world is still going, but the column isn't. Which kind of,
it's kind of a black humour to it, but it's a fair point.
Yeah, but I think that's kind of the problem with this, because if you tell us that ICU wards are going to be full next week and that we're going to have to close the whole country down again, all of us go, oh, crap, I better
do something.
Stay at home. Don't come over to my house for tea now this evening. We're all going to shut the shutters down and try and calm down a bit. And you need that kind of, it's in your face, in a bit like the countries you mentioned there, Gavin. You need that kind of emergency to be right in front of you and impacting you sometimes. Mm. And I think that's a problem here with a lot of this, is that it's so obscure. You know, we all know there's been storms. We all know there's been weather. But you know, the wind passes and the rain moves and the floods recede and we get up next week and we go again.
Yeah.
And I think for all the talk there was this week, until we actually see some of these actions in the government action plan impacting us, I don't think people can fully understand or engage.
I think you're right. I think this shock and awe, you know, generally it just doesn't work, you know, if you keep exposing people to the shock all the time. And I think we need to start talking about what it's going to mean for us in everyday life. Like, I was really struck this week for myself, for example, the heating system is about to die. So going, this is the time I'll go and get the new water pump. So I went and investigated the costings, and I was told it's going to cost me an extra 4,000. And that's even before I've done the audit, and I try and bring my house from a C2 up to a B2, and I was asking the guy, like, why is it going to cost so much extra? And he said, there's so much demand now, we're just not, the companies aren't producing the technology, the equipment that we need at a fast enough rate.
And that's why it's cost.
We're not investing enough, really, incentivizing enough this move to the green economy. I mean, the other thing coming through, obviously, the papers is the farmers, right? That's the big thing coming through. It struck me by, you know, Michael Brennan writes about it in the Sunday Business Post, and he's saying, look, if you look at the government's action plan around climate, it's actually energy that's been required to do the most work. They're talking about 60% reduction, whereas the farmers have been asked to do less amount of work, 22%. But what's really striking from some of the coverage, it's saying, well, there's a real problem in rural Ireland because their houses are going to cost more to retrofit because they're living in detached homes.
Yeah.
Incomes are lower, so they've just less money to invest in it. Mm. And
it means possibly having to get rid of fewer livestock, that literally means downsizing your business.
That's it. And they're saying basically either they're going to have to get more land because they're not allowed to use as much fertiliser. And the farmers are saying the problem is, if I reduce my livestock, I just can't make enough money to live because obviously the supermarkets are creaming off all the profits on the products. So there's some big things things that need to happen if we're going to
start. The obvious thing that's probably going to happen in rural Ireland over the next 20 years is that small holdings, small farmers, family farms are going to fade away, and you're going to end up with a more industrialised version.
Yeah.
As in, you're going to end up with farmers with bigger holdings, yeah, bigger herds, yeah, but
consolidation,
less farmers,
of smaller farms,
because
yeah,
because that's the way to make it work. And those guys, in fairness, when that happens, those guys will probably be able to run sustainable, yeah, farms, because they'll be doing it at, yeah, such a volume that, yeah, that it will work for them. But I know there are people, I know some of these people in the Midlands, yeah, who are
as an awfully man
are,
yeah,
Are quite enjoying the idea that week in, week out now we're talking about an energy crisis and blackouts, because they're going, You shut our power stations, you stopped our bogs, and now you're talking about blackouts. Well, there you go.
But there's also no point in all of us trying to adopt energy efficient technologies, like having heat pumps in our houses powered to some degree by electricity, or having electric cars, if the power that we use to provide all of that is still being made from non-renewable sources like peat or like other fossil
or
fuels.
Coal,
that you
get,
like, you have to, and that's why the energy sector is being asked to take so much of the cuts, because unless the electricity that comes out of your plug socket is sustainable, then all the stuff you do in the house can't really make much of a difference.
That's right. I mean, and that's one of the things where Ireland is behind. I mean, that's clearly from the coverage. Ireland's behind in terms of trying to shift to more renewables, feeding the national energy grid. I mean, the other thing I thought about this week as well, and you might have missed it in some of the coverage today, and it's a pity, but young people actually were playing a big role throughout all these debates on the environment. I mean, the Northern Ireland Youth Assembly were talking about the environment. It's the equivalent of our Carlow Nogue. Our Carlow Nogue were meeting with Micheál Martin, to be honest, on free transport costs. That's something they've secured from the government. These are all the things that are going to make a big difference, I think, in the long run to the energy debate. But I would like to see, to be honest, more coverage being given to children and young people who are... They are actually shaping what's happening behind the scenes as well. You do hear politicians being affected by what they have to say in this.
Just they don't pay taxes yet, though.
Yeah, that's the problem.
Well, see, this is
no
why
votes
we
in that.
Need the right to vote. The right to vote for 16 and 17-year-olds and local elections. I thought that the last budget, I was like, we have to get them the right to vote.
Just rewind for a second, because you said something interesting there for those of us who might possibly be looking at our boilers packing up in a couple of years and needing to think about... heat pumps and the like. You mentioned there, does your house actually have to be of a certain BER rating before you can even get the pump, or how does that work?
So you basically have to be at a B2 before you can actually get the pump, because they basically say it's going to be just it's going to be too expensive to heat the house. Basically with the water
because
pump
if
system
you heat, if you
that's
leak
right.
out too much heat,
so you need to get the audit done in your house, and then you have to insulate the whole house and deal with where all the heat's escaping before they'll even put it
so
into
you
the
basically
house.
Then need a retrofit with all the expense that comes with it before you can think about replacing the boiler.
And I live in a 100-year-old house, and that's one of the things coming through in the coverage as well, is it's going to take 20 years before you actually make your money back on your heating system if you have to retrofit a 100-year-old house.
Isn't that the difficulty of this debate, though? Because it's going to take you 20 years to get your money back, but you're saving the planet. So is it worth it anyway?
Because you try looking the president of Palau in the eye and tell him that it's worth him dealing with all those violent windstorms and everything.
Well, morally you should do it, but the problem is, if you're on a very low income, you'd love to make the right choice.
It's the same argument with the electric vehicles. It all comes back to money.
It comes back to incentivising and making these things affordable for people. That's what it comes back to. And that's completely and utterly possible. I mean, they incentivised coal mining for a very long period of time, and they're only starting to take away the incentives around that, particularly in developing countries. It's all possible, but they just have to make it a reality.
Which, just briefly before I go to another break, Kevin, underlines one other point you mentioned there about how it's all going to cost money. That there isn't really any guidance yet in the Climate Action Plan, published only 3 days ago, about the incentives, the carrot that's going to make you do all these things. So, for example, they talk about trying to have almost 1 million electric cars on the road by 2030. And there will come a tipping point in the next couple of years where buying a new electric car might be the same price up front and cheaper in the long run than buying a new diesel or petrol car. But not everyone buys a brand new car. A lot of people buy secondhand. I asked, was there going to be any more incentives to try and encourage people along? And they said, oh, maybe we'll do scrappage schemes. Maybe we'll do this. Maybe we'll do that. But they don't know how they're going to get there. And it's very difficult to know how you're going to achieve your destination without at least having a path mapped out.
No, and I think for most adults and most families, the most obvious thing you could do, that you'd consider doing, is getting a car. Because most people upgrade a car at some stage at least within a decade, which is what we have to play with here. And I know, like, when we got our latest car, there's no secondhand market for electric vehicles. Mm. It just doesn't exist,
yeah.
really.
Yeah.
It's not there. And to get the brand new one is incredibly expensive. Mm. And then you have to have the plugs and all the rest to go with it. So this is part of the problem. I mean, there was the measure in the budget around the cheaper travel for students. And that's brilliant. That's great. That's a really sellable idea. But I think that's the thing. They have to make this easy for people. There you go, the young people again. But they have to make it easy for people because, you know, we can all do things like recycling, which obviously has come a long way from even 5 or 6 years ago. Yeah. Now we all have separate bins in our houses, which once
and
upon
more
a time
coming.
Seemed like a crazy
now
idea.
Now more bins for bio waste and textiles coming in the next couple of years as well.
Yeah, but that was made easy for us over time because we got the green and the brown and the black bins and it was separated out and it made sense. And these things have to make sense for people. They have to be easy for people. You know, people have a lot going on in their lives nowadays, and the harder you make things, they're just not going to engage.
And there's a couple of other things I should have been thinking about earlier. You remember that the market was flooded by all the diesel cars from the UK because they had banned the resale of them there. Mm. I mean, I think there's the odd time they miss an opportunity that could make a big difference to, you know, to the environment as a whole.
I like your plugging of Cord and the Nog because it's very on brand for you, but it's very literally Mull and Oiga, August Yucky She, just the idea of just praising all the good stuff that they come up with. We will talk more about childcare, particularly when it comes to whether local politicians should have their babysitters subsidised by the state for attending council work and whether Micheál Martin is now beginning to revive Fianna Fáil's popularity once more. Don't go away. 11:46 on the record. Gavin Riley with you till 1 o'clock this lunchtime. Still joined by Kevin Doyle and Tanya Ward in studio. A couple of texts and tweets. One says, the problem with the ashram, all right, no point in doing anything in my house because the energy coming through isn't green argument is that it's analogous to the argument that there's no point in Ireland doing anything because China's doing far more damage. Says this texter, you have to do what you can. And Michael has been in touch saying, I can't believe that Gavin Riley is saying that buying a new car is one of the easiest green choices we can make. Why is there never any mention of people bicycling or public transport as much as possible? Leaving the car is the last option. It's the easiest choice that we can make with huge impact, which is a very fair point for Michael. Do let us know what you think. 53106 is the number for your text. On the record NT is our hashtag on Twitter. There's one interesting story on the front page of the Sunday Times, which is one I wanted to pick the brain of Tanya Ward on, which is this proposal from the Association of Irish Local Government, which is basically the body that represents Ireland's 949 city and county councillors. And they've written to the government seeking a number of changes to their expenses system, including that childcare costs and expenses associated with hiring carers and babysitters should be reimbursed. They often have to attend local authority meetings, which run late into the evening, and they want to be subsidised for the cost of hiring a babysitter. Tanya, what do you think?
I think that makes complete sense because if you look at the Oireachtas, they have a subsidised childcare facility, a very nice childcare facility, which is subsidised along with meals, etc. So it makes sense if you want to actually involve parents and obviously often women in local politics that you should be providing some sort of support for childcare options. I think it makes complete sense. I mean, I know there's going to be an increase in the salary for people in local politics and I think that's really important because what you were hearing from a lot of women was that, you know, very hard to actually stay as a councillor with this really small income, and then you have these high childcare costs to deal with as well. So I think if you want meaningful engagement from a broad spectrum of the population, particularly women and parents, I think it's a really good option.
There's a question though as to why those whose jobs are in local politics should be entitled to support and access that the rest of us don't get, because there's plenty of us who work in very long or antisocial hours who don't get state supports to deal with the cost of our childcare beyond the same as everyone else gets. We don't get vouchers from the states to subsidise
I think they're two different issues. I'd probably try to think of this one a bit like, you know, the Oireachtas has a childcare facility, a high grade childcare facility that's subsidised and that helps women stay in politics. Because the other issue with women in politics is the hours are extraordinarily long, very difficult to stay in. And it's one of the reasons why often a lot of women, they don't arrive into politics until later in their lives when their kids have grown up. I think the bigger issue on childcare, you're absolutely right. Why the hell are the whole lot of us spending so much money on childcare? Whereas if you actually were working and living in another country in Europe, it'll be a fraction of that. I mean, I looked at how much I spent on childcare for my two. It was 38,000 euros and it was a community creche. So it was the cheapest creche, basically, when I added it up. That's what it was. I was like, oh my God, I could have paid off a big chunk of my mortgage. And that's what we're all experiencing, to be quite honest with you.
The sigh you hear from your presenter is someone who's got a 7 week old at home who hasn't even incurred childcare costs yet.
But here's the thing, look, we need a national public childcare scheme. game, right? That, a bit like in every other country in Europe that really gets this right, the state actually subsidises a huge proportion of childcare, and it's all done. It's not a not-for-profit model. It's not businesses. It's actually a not-for-profit model that's in place. That's what we need to see in Ireland. We're going to get the best outcomes for parents, but we're absolutely going to get the best outcomes for children.
Couldn't you, I mean, I don't disagree with the idea of needing to try and deal with the cost of childcare to some degree, and I'm sympathetic to the idea that councillors who have to attend meetings as part of the job late at night will incur a higher cost than anyone else. But couldn't they just maybe try to reschedule or restructure the council working week so that those meetings don't go on until late at night?
Yeah,
it would save everyone the bother if you just had your meetings at half nine in the morning instead of half six at night.
Yeah, I think probably one of the problems is that the councillors all have other jobs, a lot of them as well,
True,
so they're trying to fit these meetings in around the other job that they have, and maybe it's a bigger question about being a councillor and maybe we should be paying them better, there should be less of them. I mean, there's possibly a bigger question there about what's happening at the local government level. I mean, I'd love to see, you know, far more changes happening at the local government level. I already mentioned earlier on, you know, the right to vote for 16 and 17 year olds, but I think that could be a real game changer, actually involving a lot more people in the political system, and they'd have a lot more interest in local politics as well, and they play a bigger role. And you know, what you end up seeing is that more young people actually are inspired to join politics. It's not just about my father was in it, my mother was in it, or the family is involved in politics. You get just a much broader spread of people.
The question I'd have, Gavin, on this one, and I do have sympathy for councillors. They are a really undervalued profession.
They are, to be fair. It is pretty much always a full-time job, and yet the current, even before the Moorhead reviews, they were getting €18,706 euro a year.
It works out about 32,000, I think, in the new pay round between expenses and the salary, which is not huge, but in fairness, a lot of them have second jobs, but a lot don't. But the question I'd have is, and this goes to the whole thing, the perception of the politics and the us and them, is if the councillors are getting free childcare, what about the journalist? I know no one's got sympathy for me, but what about the journalist that has to go and cover the meeting? What about the staff who has to facilitate the meeting? The security man on the door, woman on the door? And it does put them in this special place that I think, I don't know, I'm not subscribing to the idea that they should necessarily be singled out to get babysitting expenses, because I think you open a Pandora's box. Well, give it to us all, Tanya.
Why should the Oireachtas then have a subsidised childcare facility?
There'll be a lot of people listening to that right now wondering why they get a subsidised creche when nobody else does. One other Leinster House story before I let you go, Kevin. Page 6 of the Sunday Independent today. Hugh O'Connell writing a piece under the headline, "Rising Stock, is Micheál Martin finally winning over his critics?" And the general portrayal from Hugh is that there seems to be an attitude of things being on the up, or Micheál Martin being less in crisis than he was a few weeks ago.
Yeah, it's interesting, actually, and it kind of makes sense. And you know what it kind of is in some ways, Gavin? It's things have kind of gone quiet for Micheál. He's actually getting on with politics and doing, you know, he's going to COP and we're dealing with the latest COVID situation and boosters and all the rest of it. So it does seem a little bit like Mark McSharry is gone. So it's like, you know, even though a lot of people in Fianna Fáil kind of scoff and laugh at Mark McSharry, but every time he shouted, it got attention and it riled people. So he's kind of gone. Jim O'Callaghan is kind of pulled back after the Dublin Bay South by-election, according to the piece. And there's this kind of sense that Micheál has weathered an awful lot of storms, and the government is no longer in crisis. It still has crises, be it the energy crisis or the housing crisis,
and
healthcare crisis. But that it itself has found its feet a little bit.
How much of it is because parliamentary party meetings are no longer being held over Zoom, which, as you and I know, lent itself to wholesale leaking, which journalists would never turn down, and that it's now gone back into person, which means that even if there is somebody mouthing off in the room who's unhappy about the leadership, it doesn't get tweeted out in real time, which means that it doesn't have the same currency maybe as it used to.
Yeah, I think that's probably part of it. I mean, the parliamentary parties, and like Enda Kenny had the same thing when he was leader of Fine Gael, and people were talking for 2-3 years about when was Enda finally going to be pushed overboard. And you had that same thing where the parliamentary parties every week were pretty much reported verbatim. I think the fact that Mark McSharry is probably not in that parliamentary party is part of that as well, because he often got the party started, if you know what I mean. So it probably, the fact that they're all meeting in person though as well, it probably gives a little bit of better camaraderie and meaning of purpose. And they did have their big meeting back in September, was it?
Yeah, where the basically thinking in cabin,
it went on for hours and everybody got to have their say, and it was a little bit I know at the time a few TDs thought it was cathartic and it was a way to get it all out on the table. So look, he's, I mean, if you read the conclusion of the piece, it still concludes that he won't be Taoiseach when the handover happens at the end of next year.
In the last Red Sea poll.
But it is suggesting that maybe he might be allowed to get on with the job in the meantime.
If we get time to ask the Minister for Health about the fate of the party leader, we might do that. But that's all we have time for now. Big thanks to both for coming in this morning. Kevin Doyle, Group Head of News at Independent Newspapers, and Tanya Ward, who's Chief Executive of the Children's Rights Alliance. Stephen Donnelly will be with us after the news at 12. Don't go away.
On the Record, on News Talk.
Brought to you by PwC, a community of solvers coming together in unexpected ways. It all adds up to the new equation.